Thank you for this opportunity, a chance to be with you, yous, and family, and friends, and talk of baseball. Many of you know I'm a White Sox fan. How is it that you know that? One game this year, it's a bad year, the Kansas City Royals scored 7 runs in the bottom of the ninth to beat my White Sox. It was painful. You would agree, that was a big inning. And that is the way the Bible starts. In the beginning. In the beginning. In the beginning, Eve stole first. Adam stole second. Cain struck out Abel. The prodigal son came home. And Bill Durham, Kevin Costner notes there are 108 stitches on a baseball, and he says there are 108 beads on a rosary. Actually, there's 59 beads on a rosary. But interesting, I looked it up in Wikipedia, there are 108 beads on the Hindu prayer strand. Ballpark is often said to be similar to a church in a game like a mass. There are three strikes in an inning, similar to the Trinity, 9 positions, similar to the 9 muses in Greek mythology, or last Sunday, if you were here, we had 9 episodes of the meditation with 3 sub-episodes of the meditation. I thought Julia was just helping me prepare. The title, Sermon on the Mound, that was Ben's idea. That's my son, Benjamin. He said, Dad, you're never serious anyway. Today, my pitch is to tell you about baseball and its relationship with religion and focus on a humanist perspective. As you now know, there are many humanist perspectives. I appreciate humanism evolves. I believe in evolution. The sermon really started with my reading of the book by John Sexton, the ex-president of NYU, Baseball is a Road to God. I read it, though, with a humanist perspective. The sermon, when I first volunteered, it was Baseball is a Road to Spirituality, and I found myself wondering, is spirituality a part of humanism? But I wanted to, I realize as I talk about this, humanists agree to disagree, and I'm really sharing my perspective of humanism. I will describe what Sexton calls ineffable experiences connected with baseball and some examples of baseball and common religious experiences. I will tell you of experiences that I've had. I think I have about 3 hours of information. You don't mind, right? I'm not here to recruit you to baseball or the White Sox or humanism or UU, though you are certainly welcome to come back to any or all of it. My intention is that you find meaningful thought and meaningful experience in the everyday, of which baseball can be a part. We've already identified that many of you have been fans, that you've had a catch, you've played ball, you've struck out. So I want to tell you my story with humanism. As B told you, much of my story, but I want to tell you my experience with religion has for the most part been here since 1998, and I'm very grateful for that experience. Humanism and the ineffable, are relatively new concepts to me. When Thomas Pershlik gave the sermon be mentioned, I thought, wow, perhaps that is my core. It was a revelation. You might say a grand slam. Baseball has been a part of me for much longer. For years, I said I would be a Major League Baseball player. I read the history of the Major League several times in baseball, or in grade school. It was back in the days of the Washington Senators, the Kansas City Athletics, the Brooklyn Dodgers, we'll talk about them later, and the New York Giants. Hope springs eternal within the human breast. If anybody here has collected baseball cards, you know what that's like. I opened those packs, and I wanted Mickey Mantle, even as I didn't like him. And I got 8 Arnie Portocarrero. Since I was 6 or 7 or so, I started my days in search of White Sox scores. As an adult, I have Sox score withdrawal in October. They're usually done by October. And I'm still wanting to look for scores. And can you believe last night? I mean, there are no ties in baseball. They tied last night. It's 3-3. They'll finish the game today. I was in my parents' bedroom listening to the games. I would score the games. I'd make up a little boxes, and I'd score the games, and it was on, I could look this up in Wikipedia, Sunday, June 27th, 1950 game. Billy Pierce was pitching a perfect game. I was scoring it. It was perfect until Ed Fitzgerald got a double with two out in the ninth. I was crushed. My dad took me to Comiskey Park for ball games in the 1950s. I walked down Middlebury Street in Elkhart, Indiana, with Willard J. Frederick Sr. to catch the train to Chicago. I had much anticipation. It was a big deal to ride 100 miles to go to Chicago and to go to Comiskey Park and see the White Sox. Those are the most pleasant memories I have with my dad. Each season, starting in 1956, at the park, he bought me a yearbook. I still have those yearbooks through 1963. They helped me learn to read. Figuring out batting averages made math both necessary and interesting. His life changed. He stopped taking me to games. Fast forward, 1987. Katie and I take our family to a Sox game. I'd only been to three or four, perhaps, in the last 24 years. On that day, I had a childlike anticipation. And as we turned off to the Dan Ryan onto 35th Street, I could see White Sox Park, and I began crying. I didn't understand it. I felt embarrassed. I didn't want Beth or Ben or Katie to see me crying. And I stopped the tears, as I'm trying now. It's easier to drive in Chicago, by the way, if you can see the road. It's easier to read up here if you can see the script. So let me now detour into Sexton and religion. I say the humanist presence. His book, Baseball as a Road to God, was fascinating. And he was clear, a road, not the road. Same as the humanist said in the manifestos. And if you all fall asleep, I'm going to read Michelle Obama's speech from 2008. And I'm going to tell you that I wrote it. Sexton says, religion is not a scientific problem, and scientific methods are not capable of solving it. Yet religion is rooted in the humanist world of experience. Each of us decides for ourselves what is sacred and what is profane. Many humanists, such as Sarah Olerberg, are open to experiences that are not rationally explained. They are rather humanly explained. Remember, humanists who signed the manifesto agreed they did not have to agree. As a child, Sexton was taught by a priest to find wonder in places and things that are not remarkable, and to do that with careful inspection and introspection. This seems consistent with humanist offerings, yes? Humanists are clear that the inspection of life is clear, is key. One day, a student says to Sexton, "I understand you are a big baseball fan." He was the president of NYU, I think I mentioned that. She says, "I think the sport is silly, and I don't understand why anybody would waste time on it." In fact, one of our friends recently essentially said the same thing when Katie told her about this presentation. She said, "It's just baseball. Bill's a baseball nut." And she wasn't trying to be derogatory. That's just how she saw things. And in fact, I assume some of you came here today with that thought. And I just say thank you for coming. But some of you were immediately, even without much information, saying that you understood and that you wanted to be here and hear this point of view, and that you look forward to this presentation. Sexton says to the student, "You are among the unwashed." And he offers an independent study class, and he began the class, and the class grew so that he's not president of NYU anymore, but at the time he left there, people not only signed up in great numbers to have the class, he interviewed the students that were allowed to come to the class. That's how he made the book. The book's great. I want to read to you, it's just a little bit tough, but I want to read to you his definition of the ineffable. The aspect of reality that by its nature lies beyond comprehension and is acknowledged by the mind to be beyond the scope of the mind. So ineffable is both rational and thus humanistic, and not rational and thus, I say, human. Consider, as we talk of ineffable moments, consider the ones that you have had, related to baseball or not. Include God or don't include God. Or perhaps and hopefully you will find other ways that you were ineffably surprised by some event. And I'll just give you a quick example. I told Randy, I don't see Randy here, I told Randy about the sermon and I told him about ineffable, and he said, I know exactly what you're talking about. He said, I took my dog for a walk. I remember this time. It was when dawn was breaking and the sun was coming up and the moon was setting and there was dew on the grass, and he said, I took my dog for a walk, and he said, it was just something that I can't explain. And I thought, yeah, that's it. I have had ineffable experiences in this church and ineffable experiences related to baseball. I like noticing these experiences of life. And they will often come with surprise. Yet later, I'm going to predict accurately when there will be some ineffable experiences in our future. Sexton says the essence of religions are found deeply within ourselves. Here is baseball to John Sexton. Grace and affliction, miracles and doubt, belief and joy and ecstasy. He argues that there are moments in the game that lift us out of our regular existence, granting us an experience of standing outside of ourselves without ceasing to be ourselves. In 1890, just after Casey was written, Jacques Barzon said, "Whoever wants to know the heart and mind of America had better learn baseball, the rules and realities of the game." In 2010, a young Korean woman said, as she took Sexton's class, she said she took his class because the two most important things to understand about America are baseball and religion. So when I turn onto 35th Street and I have this experience, was it ineffable? Or rationally, I know you're thinking, rationally, it was just a lost memory of my father and perhaps a relationship I at one point idealized and perhaps longed for. Or perhaps as I turned onto 35th Street, I was quickly in touch with my desire to be a great dad. Or perhaps I was repeating in my family something that happened in my family of origin. Or from psychology, I know something about psychology. It was a buried moment that relies in a flash, triggered as I view the old park for the first time with my family. In this case, a pleasant flashback. At the moment, though, it was just an experience that I had no explanation for, just emotion, just that experience. What is baseball? Leo Durocher says, or said, many attend, but few understand. Some of you may have done this. Fathers put gloves and balls in cribs. Some want their children to be left-handed, all the better to pitch with. It is a complicated game, often a game of inches, and some say of perfect dimensions, 90 feet from base to base, 60 feet 6 inches from the pitcher's mound to home. And the field is, in fact, infinite. We are in now, theoretically, left field of Cellular One, the White Sox field. There's no rule against hitting the ball this far. But if someone can hit the ball this far, I want them on the Sox. It is a game without time limit. We play it deliberately, and we play it until it ends. Even that game in Chicago last night, they will finish it today. When the announcer says we are down to the last pitch, there may be 100 more. Or maybe that ends up being the last pitch. There was a game in the World Series a few years ago where the announcer said the Giants were down to their last pitch. And after they said that, they played 58 more outs. 54 outs is a 9-inning game, by the way. We attend to home runs and strikeouts, but games are often the result of backing up the infielder, making the pitch work harder even if you make an out, errors and double plays, and yes, sacrifices. Watch, and you can only do this in the park, the ballet of the fielders as they put on a defensive play, both prior to the pitch ball and when the ball is hit. And let me ask you this. How is it that a player can move to catch a ball in center field and he begins moving before the crack of the bat? Solve that math problem. The synchronistic part of each play is unique as each of us are unique. Here's a book you might want to read. It's titled The Nine Innings. It's by Daniel Okrent. It's a novel about a single game. On October 4th, 1955, as many Brooklyn prayed before their radios and listened, the New York Yankees' Elston Howard grounded a ball pitched by Johnny Podres to shortstop Pee Wee Reese, who threw the ball to first baseman Gil Hodges. And at the moment the ball hit the glove, the world changed for Dodger fans. Is that right, Nancy? Is that right, Tom? It was an ineffable moment for a city of millions and even some in West Virginia. The legend in Brooklyn was you could hear this game by walking down the street in Brooklyn because every window was open and every radio was tuned in. It was them bums in a history of waiting until next year. Hope springs eternal, yes? For me, it was my first baseball memory. I was 7. I knew of Sandy Amrose and Yogi Berra's fly and Johnny Podres, who won Game 2, and I knew that I hated the Yankees and the Dodgers would wait till next year. By the way, I no longer hate the Yankees and feel from my humanist and psychological perspective that hating a sports team or an athlete is wrong and a waste of energy. It is in contrast to most religious teachings. It is not healthy psychologically. And then I read an article. It's interesting. You can go both sides. I read an article about a man who lives in Boston. He's an avid Sox fan, Red Sox fan, and he hates the Yankees. And his love of the Red Sox and the hate of the Yankees keeps him alive. I try to use hate only as a part of my vocabulary to describe things such as poverty or social injustice. Of course, I had no concept at how ineffable that moment was for Dodger fans. I'm guessing tears and cheers in a parade, and I bet the feeling lasted more than a day. And then, just 2 years after that, the Dodgers moved to L.A. They sinned. Am I right on this, Dodger people? Yeah, I'm right. Yeah, thank you. And those Dodger fans, did they become L.A. Dodger fans? Maybe some did. I heard a yes out there. I don't know. Did they vote with logic or their broken hearts? It was the same guys, the same Dodger name, but not the same in their hearts, not the same in their soul, and not the same in their psyche. So Katie and I, we go to spring training this year, and we've got these people behind us. We take a picture of us. It's the Reds versus the Colorado Rockies. And he kindly takes a picture, and I say, "You got a baseball story?" He says, "No." I said, "Okay." And I say, "Well, you're wearing a New York Islanders." That's a hockey team. He's wearing a New York Islanders hat, and I say, "Right. Well, you're from New York." He says, "No, I'm from Brooklyn." Now, some of you get that, right? And I say, "Well, so I say," he looks to me like he's 85. And I say to him, "Well, were you there when the Dodgers won in 1955? And it's like this. "Oh, yeah, I was there." He got 20 years younger before my eyes, and he told me about being there. And he told Katie about being there. He said, "Oh, yes, I was delivering meat. And I remember a woman coming out of the store, ringing a bell, saying, 'The Dodgers won the World Series. The Dodgers won the World Series.'" And Katie asked him, she said, "Do you know where you were?" He says, "Yes, I was on 82nd Street." And so I don't know if he had an ineffable time when the Dodgers won, but he was having a good time telling us about that story. He was having a special moment. He was transformed at that time. So I talk to Carl Erskine. I go and tell Carl Erskine, the great Dodger pitcher who lives in Anderson, a great member of their community, and I tell him about this story. And he says this. He says, I wonder if he lived on the same part of 82nd Street that I lived on. Those Dodgers lived with the people they played for. They were a part of the team. In October 2004, the Yankees management commits the sin of pride. Up 3-0 in the bottom of the ninth of the American League Championship Series, the Yankees in the lead, and their Hall of Fame reliever, Mariano Rivera, on the mound, the Yankee brass left their suites to go for interviews as if the game were over. The game's not over till the last out, by the way. The Red Sox won that game, and they won the next three. No one had come from behind 3-0 in a series, a 7-game series in baseball, and no one has done it since. And the Red Sox won the World Series. And 86 years, it had been 86 years since they won. And they had suffered the curse of trading Babe Ruth. They had a parade and remembered loved ones who had remained loyal with him. Muncie resident Jamie Bergen listened to Red Sox games with her grandmother in her Massachusetts kitchen as they both dreamed and hoped and perhaps prayed for the Red Sox championship. After they won, Jamie took a Red Sox pennant and placed it carefully on her grandmother's grave. And when she was in the cemetery, she saw many other graves recently decorated with Red Sox pennants. Ineffable. 50 years after the Dodgers win, on October 25th, 2005, Orlando Palmeiro grounds to shortstop Juan Uribe, who barehands at the first baseman Paul Konerko. And at the moment the ball hits the leather, the White Sox win a championship. It was their first in 88 years, stopping the curse of throwing the 1919 series. Banners in Chicago and a parade. A million show up. And uncounted placed flags on graves of loved ones who had remained with them in their heart and faithful to their team. The agony and the ecstasy of that final play, yes, in 55 for the Dodgers, and the same play, short to first, 50 years later for the White Sox. We sit back and ask for victory, or is it a prayer? Will they actually complete what now looks possible to others? Hope, after all, springs eternal. And here, I confidently predict ineffable experiences will be the case when the Cubs or the Indians eventually win. There will be pennants on graves of those that came before. When my White Sox won, I cried and I called Ben on the phone. I'm doing my elliptical machine. I will put the Sox TV in and I'll cry again while I'm doing the elliptical machine. I think it's silly. But that's what happens. But I think it's human. I often said to myself, just once in my life, let my Sox win. So I don't know if that was a prayer, but I know I said it, and I wondered if it would ever be rewarded. The faithful to the Cleveland Indians in 1997 and to the Rangers in 2011 had a different experience. They were down to potential last pitches for their championships, but their teams did not succeed. Their prayers and their hopes were not answered. Those fans, though, remained faithful, with a humanist hope springing eternal. And this, by the way, the Indians are pretty good this year. They might do it this year. Right, Carl? Could happen. The Cubs might do it. Right, Jason? And to be clear, though, it's not just about winning. In a broader sense, winning diminishes the fact that the ineffable feeling, while at times accompanied by winning, is more complicated than that. Don't forget, Cub fans and Indian fans are also with faith and some level proud of their loyalty. Hope springs eternal. Their teams, heroes, and families have ineffable moments as they enjoy the game and as their team pursues titles. And it's not just in the majors. You may have seen the article on Victory Field a couple of weeks ago. They talked about Wally Myers. He's 89. He's had season tickets to the Indianapolis Indians since 1957. He tries to attend every game. He now goes to the game. He has to leave by the fourth or fifth inning, but he still attends the games. He's 89. What do you think it might have been? Anybody here from Daleville? No. What do you think it was like for Daleville when the Daleville Broncos won this year's state boys championship, the first state championship of any kind for boys in Daleville? Where Katie and I were, we can sit on our porch and have coffee And we look across the street and we see a family of six. They're here today, playing in the driveway or in the backyard. They're playing ball. And at the most basic, the seven-year-old, Thatcher, raise your hand, Thatcher, pitches the ball to the four-year-old Quinn. And Quinn can hit a pitched ball. And when she hits it, she runs the bases, carrying her pink bat. Apparently, each hit is a home run. And later, Quinn gives the ball to a two-year-old that her mother babysits for. And Quinn sets back and cocks her bat, and she says to the two-year-old, "Throw, throw." So far, as I know so far, that two-year-old has not thrown. But someday that little girl will understand what the ball is for, and eventually she will teach someone else how to do that. In Field of Dreams, my favorite movie, it's a poetry. Field of Dreams is poetry. I wanted to do James Earl's voice, but he was playing Terrence Mann. The one constant through all the years, Ray, has been baseball. America has rolled by like an army of steamrollers. It has been erased like a blackboard, rebuilt and erased again. But baseball has marked time. This field, this game is part of our past, Ray. It reminds us of all that was once good and could be again. Oh, people will come, Ray. People will most definitely come. We have visited the Field of Dreams. For me, it was ineffable. But I'm not going to tell you about that today. In September 2004, Maglio Ordóñez hits a walk-off home run in a meaningless game against the Yankees. My son calls me. He holds the phone up to the crowd. And he says, "Dad, hear this. The fans in Chicago are going wild." And he's with a Yankees fan. And the Yankee fan thoroughly enjoys the moment. He said, this is exciting. This is awesome. Well, the Yankees are already clinched, so if they'd have lost an important game, it might have been different. The Royals win a big game in 2014. They're making a comeback. Last year, they're the champions. The headline in Kansas City says, "Resurrection." Did anyone have a special feeling about Derek Jeter in his last game and his last at bat in the cathedral named Yankee Stadium? I know I did, in spite of being tired of all the goodbyes. By the way, some pundits felt the need to point out Jeter is not Jesus. Did you watch the game that Cal Ripken broke Lou Gehrig's record of 2,130 consecutive games? They stopped the game, and Ripken ran around Camden Yards slapping fans' hands as they cheered and cheered and cheered. There's some Red fans here. Did you pay attention when Pete Rose broke the all-time hit record of 4,192? Are you familiar with Lou Gehrig's speech in Yankee Stadium on July 4th, 1939? He was suffering from ALS, later known as Lou Gehrig's disease, and he was rather quickly dying, 2 years in fact. And he said this, and if you've heard it, you've heard it with the echo of the stadium. He said, today, I consider myself, the luckiest man, on the face of the earth. 60,000 were there. I'm sure speechless. Did you pay attention when McGuire and Socha broke Ruth and Maris's records? Did you pay attention of the return of Billy Buckner to Boston, with the GOAT of the 87 series? Boston forgave Buckner, and I believe forgave themselves. It was a moving tribute. The Cubs make active effort to forgive Steve Bartman, and I think to forgive themselves. Bartman is not yet ready. Some think the offer is to rid themselves of the curse, but I believe the offer is much deeper than that. Bart Giamonte, former commissioner of baseball, tells about how hard it is to get home. The journey must also start once more. The bat, an oar over the shoulder, until there is an end to all journeying. Our lives are never slow for long, yet baseball, Sexton says, calls us to go home. So living slow brings us to the seventh inning stretch. So I'm going to ask you to rise as you are willing and able and join us in singing, "Take Me Out to the Ball Game." And when you sing this, you can insert your team's name when it says for the home team, and we're not going to do it in rounds. Take me out to the ball game. Take me out with the crowd. Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jacks. I don't care if I ever get back, for it's root, root, root for the White Sox. If they don't win, it's a shame. It's 1, 2, 3 strikes, you're out at the old ball game. Started in Comiskey Park. Took it Wrigley, Harry Carey took it to Wrigley Field. I love the line, "I don't care if I ever get back." It's meditative. Just be where you are. Get your beer here. Red Hots, Red Hots. Get your Red Hots, peanuts, Cracker Jacks. It's a better game in person than on the radio. I'm looking at this. I'm going too long, and I'm going to eliminate some stuff here to get us out of here. Baseball has long been a standing example of social justice that humanists stand for. The quote is, "The arc of history is long and bends toward social justice." In baseball, that has been the case with Irish Jews, blacks, Hispanics, Asians, all of whom eventually participated because of their ability, not because of their religion or the color of their skin or their nationality. The quote of "The arc of history," by the way, is credited by some to Theodore Parker, a Unitarian and a humanist. Gay people have long participated, though not yet openly. We are most familiar with the story of Jackie Robinson. Martin Luther King said of Robinson, "A pilgrim that walked in the lonesome byways toward the high road of freedom. He was a set-inner before set-ins, a freedom rider before the freedom rides." King could turn a phrase, yes? Can you imagine what it was like for blacks at that time in America's game, that they couldn't participate? Yes, when he came, they could now participate. And they brought fans to the ballpark. They saw Robinson and later Campanella, Newcomb and others, and Larry Doby in the American League. Blacks greeted Robinson at the train station when the Dodgers came to town. They showed up in large numbers at the games. The fans, black and white, came to see Robinson. Can you imagine, again, what it was like for a black person at that time to have to be represented in America's game, a game that had been declined to them for over a half a century? Have you played catch? Getting close. Annually, Ben says to me, yeah, it's a line from the Field of Dreams. We do it across the street from the White Sox ballpark where they have the ball, the diamond in the field. And I know my line, which is also from the Field of Dreams. I say, "Yes, I'd like that." When we do it, it's just a smacking of the ball against the lever, no different than when Reese threw to Hodges. And the feeling of the sting on the palm of the hand, just as when I was a kid. And after the catch, we stand in the batter's boxes that I used to see when I entered under the bleachers, the same space where Nellie Fox and Minnie Minoso and Shoeless Joe Jackson and Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig and Josh Gibson stood and Cool Papa Bell. We mimic them at the plate, and we put our foot firmly on home and go to the game of the day. At the Baseball Hall of Fame, we're looking at the Ted Williams plaque. In Baseball Hall of Fame, everybody's just a baseball fan. They don't care about their teams. At least when we were there that day, and this guy comes up to us, he said, "Can I tell you a story?" He's a Yankee fan. He's got a Yankee hat on. And we say, "Well, yeah, you can tell us a story." He said, "Well, my son," he said, when I was a kid, my dad said to me, he said, "Son, you may want to come in and see this." He's a Yankee fan. He says, "The great Ted Williams is at bat, and this may be his last at bat." And the man's crying as he's talking to us. And he tells us about how Ted Williams hit a home run and how he shared that moment with his father. Rick, you can put the other picture up of Comiskey Park. But I'm not going to tell that story because I'm behind. But I'm going to tell you this. I'm going to tell you how beautiful, you might ask, is a baseball field. A friend of mine took his girlfriend to a minor league park in Akron and proposed to her at night under the lights, just the two of them in the ballpark. And she said yes. And he's my son-in-law now. Okay, one final story. 1951. Sorry, Dodger fans. The Dodgers have a great league. They're 14 games ahead in August. Carl Erskine told me it was one of the greatest collapses in baseball history. The Dodgers didn't play bad, but the Giants played great. They won 37 out of 44 games. And they had a playoff. Giants won the first. It was a three-game playoff. Giants win the first game. Dodgers win the second game. The score was 4-1 in the bottom of the ninth. And the fans perhaps thought they'd put up even money now if Willie Mays got to bat. Some of them got up to go, leaving air the rest, but Mays was the sixth hitter in the lineup. The Giants score a run. And now just as in Casey, the score is 4-2 with that inning left to play, and there's a man on second and a man on third, just like in the poem. But it's Bobby Thompson that comes to the plate. Willie Mays is on deck. Chuck Dreesen, the Dodger manager, thinks the great Don Newcomb tired and calls the bullpen. Erskine, the bullpen coach, says is breaking his curveball in the dirt. So in comes Ralph Branca. Thompson takes the first pitch. He says, perhaps ain't my style. And then Branca lets the next pitch go, and here's the call is done by Russ Hodges. It's a long fly ball. I do believe it's going to be. I believe the Giants win the pennant. The Giants win the pennant. Woo! They are going crazy. The Giants win 5-4, and they're picking Bobby Thompson up and carrying him off the field. The shot heard around the world. They were listening in Korea. Ineffable in a very pleasant way for Giant fans. Probably not so happy for the Dodger fans. But I'll bet it helped them more enjoy that 1955 season. Bobby Thompson played two more years for the Giants and was traded to the Braves. He got hurt for the Braves, and Hank Aaron took his place. He wasn't needed anymore. Branca played two more years for the Dodgers. They didn't get rid of him. He was still their teammate. He could still pitch. They both returned. He was traded, and then he returned in 1956. Thompson came back in 1957, perhaps to play the last game symbolically in the Polo Grounds. Years after the home run, Thompson received a letter from a Marine who had been in a foxhole in Korea. It said in part, I was in a bunker in the front line of Korea with my buddy listening to the radio. It was contrary to orders, but he was a Giants fanatic. He never made it home, and I promised him that if I ever got back, I'd write and tell you about the happiest moment of his life. It's taken me this long to put into my feeling into words, but on behalf of my buddy, thanks, Bobby. Ralph Branca's story was different. After the game, Ralph Branca prayed, and he asked God, why me? Yep, he played on the 52 and 53 Dodgers. He was one of them. He could still pitch. He later spoke at banquets, often with Thompson. Eventually, they became friends. The Dodgers did not get rid of Branca for the pitch, and the Giants did not keep any longer Thompson for any longer than Branca was on the Dodgers. Branca, he's still alive. He's 90 now. And he is grateful to have been a boy of summer with Robinson, Erskine, Campanella, and the rest. He's grateful for the pitch in 1951. He is now, like Casey in my story, pleased to have been a part of baseball history and yes, a part of American history. Well, that's it. I've tried to present a view of religion that could include baseball and a view of baseball that could include religion. There are ways, I believe, that baseball can be a road to spirituality, a road to humanism. What are your roads in your own personal human definition of religion? Baseball is, of course, only one road. There are many others. In part, we can find them, or perhaps we can be open to the roads finding us. Be open. Let hope spring eternal. Pay attention. Play ball. So be it.